Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
We wouldn't be taking action if we didn't feel like it was an emergency. This is about as close to an emergency as you could get in fisheries.
The federal government could take over management of silver salmon on the lower Kuskokwim River. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 15th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a former Mat-Su Borough Assembly member says Representative David Eastman shouldn't hold office.
We all received the same form letter back. He's an oath keeper, but that's not a problem.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
Police have arrested a suspect in connection with last week's fatal fire in Bethel that killed 3 people. Police have charged 35-year-old Adam Andrew with 11 felony counts and 6 misdemeanor counts. Among the most serious charges are 3 counts of murder in the second degree and 1 count of arson. Andrew has pleaded not guilty to his misdemeanor counts and has not yet entered a plea for the felonies. He's being held at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Correctional Center. Police say Andrew started the fire that began around 4 a.m. on Friday. 3 people in an apartment died after they were trapped inside, and an additional 5 people were injured. The fire destroyed 2 units in a larger apartment complex and damaged an additional 4 units. Andrew lives in a unit near the ones that were the most severely burned. Investigator Skylar Smith wrote in a report that Andrew set fire in the walkway between the 2 apartments that suffered the most damage while he was, quote, blackout drunk. Andrew told police he remembers only arriving at the apartments and then waking up in police custody. He told them he did not set fire to the building. He also suggested it could have been an electrical fire. He told Smith he had issues with electricity in his own unit. The neighbors said no sprinklers or fire alarms went off. Andrew is scheduled to appear next in court for a hearing next Tuesday. The federal government has announced plans to take over management of silver salmon in the federal waters of the lower Kuskokwim River for the first time ever. That's if the silver run stays low. KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports.
According to both federal and state biologists, silver runs are low and late, and they want to implement closures to help protect the runs.
We wouldn't be taking action if we didn't feel like it was an emergency. This is about as close to an emergency as you could get in fisheries. We're trying to preserve what little is left of coho salmon, and it just really is a little amount.
Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge Manager Boyd Blehovdy announced his intentions in Wednesday's Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group meeting. He said he'll draft the plans in close consultation with the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission and biologists. He also said despite the restrictions, he plans to hang on to at least a few subsistence openings for silver fishing. If the new federal emergency actions come into play, it will mark one of the first times coho salmon fishing has been this heavily restricted on the Kuskokwim. Managers are calling for restrictions because of the low numbers of silvers swimming up the river. According to data from the Bethel test fishery, the silver run is the second lowest in the past decade. The state says the run is not projected to make escapement goals. The federal announcement of emergency management actions comes one day after the state released its own management recommendations, which the working group failed to pass. In the rejected plan, the managers from the state government had recommended closing the entire Kuskokwim and all of its tributaries to subsistence fishing for silver salmon starting next week through the end of September. Subsistence users up and down the river balked at the state's plan to close the entire river for more than a month, calling it overly restrictive. Tribal Chief Mike Williams Sr. of Akiak says he recognizes the need to protect the run, but for him, there's a more important aspect.
My biggest fear is that drastic management action without any food to eat for 2 months is not good for the families and our health.
Other users with traditional knowledge like Fritz Charles said the river's only feeling its first pulse of fish right now, and they expect another pulse to come through soon. He also said that explains the small body size of the first run of silvers.
When there's fish like this, they're extra small this year. That means they're going to be plentiful this year.
The working group unanimously voted to support the federal management of coho in the federal waters of the Lower Kuskokwim River. It also voted to recommend the state mirror lower river management restrictions in the state-controlled sections of the river. State biologist Nick Smith said he would have to see what the federal actions would be before he would agree to mirror them. He also defended his call for stricter regulations on the entire river.
Right now, we're not projected to meet escapement, so the harvest needs to be curtailed until a time that we make escapement.
Smith has purview over management decisions in the Middle and Upper River, Sections 4 and 5, but is prevented by the courts from announcing conflicting management decisions in Sections 1 through 3 of the Lower River. That's because of a restraining order issued against the state of Alaska. The order is part of an ongoing lawsuit that the federal government has filed against the state for management control of the river. The federal government agreed with the state's assessment of the low run, but still said it wanted to protect at least some subsistence fishing. Refuge manager Boyd Blehovdy said he would not announce the emergency special action details prior to Saturday, saying he would need some time to draft a plan in consultation with federal and tribal biologists and the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission. In Bethel, I'm Olivia Eberts.
Alaska's special general election for U.S. House is tomorrow. Tomorrow is also Alaska's regular primary. Here to discuss this hybrid ballot is Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin. First of all, Liz, how can people vote? And what if they're confused about where to go?
We do have a lot of new polling places this year and new district numbers. By now, everyone should have gotten a voter card in the mail saying where your new polling place is. It's not actually on the card. It's on the sheet of paper that the card came in. And if you've misplaced that piece of paper, the Division of Elections website is your best friend. The easiest way to find that on the website is to go to the My Voter Information feature. And all you need to do is put in your name and voting city, and it will tell you the address of your polling place.
That's right. I tried it. It also asks you if you're a robot, and I think that might be triggering for some people.
Yeah, just asked you if you're a robot.
And I was like, no. Thanks for asking.
A real robot couldn't answer it that way.
Okay. Let's say you requested a ballot in the mail and now you're ready to vote it. How do you do that?
Ballots have to be postmarked by tomorrow at the latest. Your safest bet might be to deliver that ballot in person to any polling place.
Right. Tell us again what we're voting on. First, tell us about the special election.
And this is where most of the action is. We've got three people on the ballot: Democrat Mary Peltola and Republican Sarah Palin and Nick Begich. This is Alaska's very first chance to vote a ranked choice ballot. This is for U.S. House to serve the remainder of the year. So you can just vote for one and done, or make the most of it by ranking the three candidates, 1, 2, and 3. That way, if your favorite finishes last, you can still exercise a choice among the remaining two candidates.
Gotcha. And we can still write in for this election, right? Remind us how write-ins even work.
Well, to count, you have to choose one of the registered write-ins. There are 6 for this election. You can see the list on the Division of Elections website when you look up the candidates for the special general. The best known and best funded of the write-ins is Republican Tara Sweeney, a former Assistant Interior Secretary for Indian Affairs. You can write in a candidate and then rank him or her just like you would the other candidates.
Right. So it's not like you can write in Mickey Mouse, who is not a real mouse, or Santa Claus, who turns out had been a candidate that didn't make it to the general election. You have to pick one of the write-in candidates that is registered.
Right. Otherwise, your write-in won't count, but they'll go to your next choice.
Gotcha. Okay, so that's the special, and that's on one side of the ballot, and then this is also a regular primary election for every other office, including the next term in Congress. And this is our new primary system, right?
Yeah, on the flip side is the primary for governor, U.S. House, and U.S. Senate, and the state legislature. You just pick one candidate for each race. All the candidates, regardless of party, are on the same ballot. That's what's new about our new primary. And primaries from now on, they're not ranked choice, and there is no write-in option. That comes in November.
So it's a special general election on one side of the ballot and a pick one primary on the other.
You got it. And when in doubt, read the directions.
And definitely elections.alaska.gov has a ton of information there, and definitely recommend that for folks. You can see a sample ballot even to kind of get your head straight about that. Also, I suppose that's where we're going to be looking for results. But when will we know who won?
Well, I would recommend you look at our excellent alaskapublicmedia.org/elections website, because we're going to have this nifty widget. But yeah, when will we know who won? In the primaries, the top four in each race advance, so we'll have a lot of winners. In the special general, to pick who will serve in the U.S. House for the rest of the year, we will not know that until the end of the month.
The end of the month? Why so late?
Because we have to wait until all the mail-in ballots arrive. They have 15 days to trickle in, and then the Division of Elections will determine who finished third and reallocate the losers' ballots according to the voters' second choice. So we won't know who won the special until the end of the month.
All right. Well, we will certainly be covering that. And like Liz said, you can find all of our reporting about this election and that fancy widget that we're going to have at alaskapublic.org/elections. That was Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin. Liz, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, electric vehicle drivers head to the northernmost point on the road system.
With this event, we're showing that it's possible to electrify even the most remote parts of Alaska.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's waters and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help stop aquatic hitchhikers by remembering to clean boots, boats, and trailer to remove plants, animals, and mud. Drain bilge, ballast, and buckets before leaving the area, and dry equipment before using it in a new body of water. Learn more at stopaquatichitchhikers.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The U.S. Department of the Interior will be required to hold an oil and gas lease sale in Cook Inlet before the end of the year. That's according to a section of the new Inflation Reduction Act passed by the U.S. House on Friday. The 730-page act awaiting President Joe Biden's signature tackles tax and health reform and invests billions of dollars in renewable energy. But it also requires the feds to hold several lease sales this year, including a long-contested sale in Cook Inlet. Even when the feds have scheduled Cook Inlet lease sales in the past, those plans always come with the qualifier that they could be canceled due to lack of industry interest. And they have been, repeatedly. But the new act says the lease sale must go forward before December 31st, 2022. That means the Bureau of Ocean and Energy Management can't change or cancel the sale regardless of whether they think they'll get bids, says Liz Mehring, Advocacy Director for Cook Inlet Keeper.
However, just because BOEM holds a sale doesn't necessarily mean that anybody will show up to bid.
Hannah Ray, a spokesperson for Senator Lisa Murkowski, says the lease sale requirement was added by Murkowski and West Virginia Democrat Senator Joe Manchin. Ray says the goal is to remedy the decision earlier this year to cancel the sale and to make sure that won't happen again. Before it can put out a request for bids, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has to release a final environmental impact statement, as well as a final plan and a record of decision.
It means that BOEM will have to kind of act expeditiously in order to start complying with the steps that are directed.
The sale falls outside the agency's typical five-year window for lease sale plans. There was no sale during the previous five-year period, which ended this summer. A potential lease sale was canceled this spring. A new draft plan released in July does float the idea of a lease sale in Cook Inlet in 2026. former Mat-Su Borough Assembly member has filed suit to disqualify State Representative David Eastman from holding elected office based on his membership in the Oath Keepers organization. KTNA's Philip Manning reports.
Near the end of July, Randall Kowalke filed a lawsuit against Representative David Eastman, the Alaska Division of Elections, and the division's director, Gail Finumiai. The suit seeks to disqualify Eastman from serving as a legislator and remove him from the November 8th general election ballot. The suit centers on Eastman's membership in the Oath Keepers, a group that has been a focus of investigations into the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Kowalke says Eastman's continued membership in the group violates the Alaska Constitution's loyalty clause.
We have a constitution that identifies sedition as a disqualifying factor belonging to that type of organization. We have a representative who, I think the phrase that was used, that has doubled down on his Oath Keeper membership, and I don't think it can be both ways.
Article 12, Section 4 of the Alaska Constitution prohibits anyone who advocates or belongs to a group who advocates the violent overthrow of the state or federal government from holding office. Kowalke and his attorneys from the Northern Justice Project say Eastman's membership in the Oath Keepers meets those criteria. Kowalke and others filed complaints earlier this year with the Alaska Division of Elections to have Representative Eastman disqualified from running for re-election. His suit says the response from DOE did not meet the agency's requirement to uphold the Constitution, and that's why it and its director are also named as defendants.
I guess there were like 25 or 26 of us that had sent letters in, and as I understand it, we all received the same form letter back. He's an Oath Keeper, but that's not a problem.
Representative Eastman says the lawsuit is being used as a means to target a political opponent.
It isn't an academic question. Well, gee, you know, there's this thing that, you know, the Constitution included, you know, back in 1956. Yeah, I wonder if we can, you know, make it apply to, you know, our events today and somehow use that in a sense to attack our political opponents or candidates that we don't, you know, agree with.
Kowalke, who is a former member of the Mat-Su Borough Assembly and a former candidate for state senate, says he considers himself a conservative and was a longtime member of the Republican Party before switching his affiliation to nonpartisan. While Eastman says the violence on January 6th should not have taken place, he finds value in the founding principles of the Oath Keepers.
I think it's extremely important that all of our public officials, all of our former law enforcement and military do take that oath seriously and continue, you know, on behalf of the country that they have been serving, to follow and honor and defend and support that Constitution.
Eastman was in Washington, D.C. on January 6th of last year, but says he was only there to hear the speech by then-President Donald Trump and did not enter the U.S. Capitol. 11 members of the Oath Keepers have been charged with seditious conspiracy as a result of the attack on the Capitol, and 2 have pled guilty. Kowalke says Eastman's insistence is not enough.
I've had a couple people tell me, well, yeah, he was in D.C., but he didn't do anything. Mm. And if that him saying that is proof, then I'd like to see some proof that that's the truth.
The Alaska Division of Elections is represented by the Department of Law in suits like these. Patty Sullivan, spokesperson for the Department of Law, says in an email responding to a request for comment that the Department of Law's position is that DOE and Director Finumiai followed the appropriate process in responding to complaints about Eastman. The Department of Law intends to ask that DOE and Director Finumiai be dismissed as defendants in the case. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
The Kenai Peninsula Borough School District is tweaking several school bus routes in response to bus driver shortages and increased business costs. Kevin Lyon is the district's director of planning and operations. He says the bus company the district works with is struggling to find local drivers. They're bringing in 14 out-of-area drivers who will cover 12 routes in the district.
Just trying to make us so we can get started. Meanwhile, they have some folks in training that are trying to get ready to be able to drive a bus, but we're still looking for drivers.
The difficulties aren't unique to the Kenai District, as there are also driver shortages in Anchorage and the Mat-Su. In addition to staff shortages, the Kenai District's 10-year contract with the bus company also adjusts for inflation, making the costs of doing business and adding routes more expensive. And gas prices are high, which adds up across the district's large service area, which includes driving over 6,000 total miles a day. Lyon says the district is trying to minimize the impacts of the route changes to affect as few students as possible. For example, it's combining certain routes that service students in Kenai and Soldotna. In some cases, buses will no longer travel down residential streets and will instead pick students up at centralized locations closer to the highways. Meanwhile, the district is offering bonuses for referrals and signing bonuses for new bus drivers. Lyon says it needs 12 more drivers before Labor Day.
We are bringing those out of area ones in to cover. They're covering till Labor Day. If we don't get 12 more on the thing, then we're going to have to do more drastic cuts.
The Kenai Peninsula's first day of school is tomorrow.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547. Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
The Sitka Assembly last week agreed on first reading to set aside $600,000 to replace the heating system in the middle school, a system that was state-of-the-art just 11 years ago. Thanks to a projected sales tax surplus from this year's record cruise tourism, finding the money wasn't really an issue. The Assembly's concerns had more to do with the quick demise of modern equipment and what the future holds for Sitka's aging school buildings. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The heating began to fail in Blatchley Middle School last November. The district set up space heaters to keep the building habitable, but repairing the school's 5 Mitsubishi heat pumps meant bringing in a refrigeration contractor who wasn't able to check on the equipment until Christmas Eve. The contractor ordered a part, which didn't arrive until February, and then the contractor himself bowed out of the picture. But that didn't matter. When the district finally brought in a Mitsubishi specialist, the prognosis was not good.
There's no amount of preventative maintenance, according to this contractor, that would have alleviated this failure.
Mike Bartolaba is head of maintenance for the Sitka School District. He said the experts traced the problem to the installation of the equipment directly on the concrete slab, rather than to the heat pumps themselves, which have a service life of somewhere over 15 years. Blatchley Middle School didn't quite get 10 years out of the pumps, and the warranty expired after 7. The school buildings in Sitka are owned by the city. Municipal Administrator John Leach wanted some answers.
If these were installed incorrectly, which is what we're hearing, I want to find out if Mitsubishi signed off on that in the first place. And I need that question answered. But that's going to take us some time to evaluate that. But it's not done with just spend the money on the appropriation and call it good. There's a lot of research we still need to do. But again, it's very time sensitive and we need to get heat in the rooms before winter gets here.
Blatchley Middle School is the only major building in the Sitka District that doesn't have a redundant heating system. The interruptible electrical service and oil-fired boilers that are in many public buildings in Sitka were decommissioned when the heat pumps were installed, and bringing them back would be costly. So would attempting to adapt another brand of heat pump to all of the Mitsubishi controls and distribution systems. Ron Vinson, Sitka's asset manager, suggested that the city take its hard knocks and replace the Mitsubishi heat pumps with the latest equipment from the same manufacturer, renew the warranty, and use the experience to prolong the lives of similar heat pumps throughout the city, 11 in all.
You start identifying issues like the coil failure being, you know, close to finish grade, as we've experienced with these. You start figuring out how you can modify your other systems. And so it's not just a one-off that we can fix the school district's, you know, heat pumps. We can take lessons learned and apply them in other places too.
The Sitka Assembly was not especially enthusiastic, having to consider an emergency appropriation of $600,000 to solve a problem discovered 10 months ago. Member Tor Christensen said what other members may have been thinking.
I'm a little irritated by the timing because, I mean, we don't have a choice. I mean, we're going to be spending money, whether it's this or something else. from what I understand, there were complaints about the heating system last school year. Why are we only hearing about this now?
Mayor Steven Eisenbeiss was concerned about the simultaneous failure of five expensive heat pumps. He thought it signaled that larger issues may be looming in the Sitka School District.
I think the need to replace the school buildings is known, but no one's actually put their foot down and said, we're going to do this. So I'm hoping that this is also a wake-up call to the assembly that issues like this are imminent with our schools. I hope that they're not. I hope that this isn't going to continue. But I have a feeling that our school buildings are reaching the end of their useful life without a major rehab, and we need to get ahead of that at this point.
The assembly unanimously passed on first reading a supplemental budget appropriation of $600,000 to replace the heat pumps, $390,000 for the pumps themselves, plus a 40% contingency to cover everything else. A special meeting will likely be called for a second reading to expedite the repairs. The appropriation doesn't specify that the equipment has to be Mitsubishi. Member Tor Christensen quipped, "My answer would be wood stoves everywhere, but I don't think that's going to be real popular." Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
10 electric vehicles set out on Friday from Fairbanks on a 1,000-mile journey up the Dalton Highway and back. The Arctic Road Rally is intended to demonstrate the ability of electric vehicles, or EVs, to operate in the far north. Organizers say the rally will promote efforts to enable EVs to drive anywhere on the state's road system.
With this event, we're showing that it's possible to electrify even the most remote parts of Alaska and very quickly and cost-effectively.
Dimitri Shane is executive director of the Alaska Electric Vehicle Association. He'll be one of those traversing the remote stretch between Fairbanks and Elliptic Point, the northernmost point in North America accessible by road.
Yeah, I'll be driving my wife's Tesla, and I hope she forgives me for driving her car down the stretch of road.
The State Department of Transportation is helping out by providing power for an electric vehicle charger at the Yukon River Crossing, the first of four charging stations on the route. Tim Leach heads Launch Alaska's transportation program. He hopes the rally will teach car manufacturers, charging station suppliers, and startups how they might make EVs accessible to Alaskans wherever they live in the state.
We're interested in increasing the awareness and adoption of electric vehicles here in the state of Alaska. We want to make sure that electric vehicle savings and the emissions benefits are accessible to all folks who are interested in electric vehicles.
The 1,096-mile trip is scheduled to wrap up tomorrow. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Olivia Eberts in Bethel, Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Tim Ellis in Delta Junction. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight is Eric Bork. Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline since 1977, from Prudhoe Bay to the Port of Valdez.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.